Okay, it's 3 o'clock now, so we can start. But just for my own personal interest, how many of you were at Ajahn Brahmadi's Sutta Retreat, which has just finished? 1, 2, 3, only three. Okay, because I was thinking that, my God, how many people are Sutta junkies? They've had 9 days of suttas, and as soon as it's finished, they come for another sutta class. But anyway, this suttas today, there's two suttas which I was asked one sutta I was asked to present, and it's a little bit short, so another sutta comes afterwards. And these are questions which people do ask, and so hopefully these suttas will answer them. So as usual, when I'm teaching the suttas, I usually begin by doing Namo Tassa 3 times, first of all. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. So the suttas today are two short suttas, but very well known and often quoted suttas, all about four ways of practice at the beginning, and then afterwards another four ways to attain enlightenment coming at the after this one. And because of copyright and stuff, when Bhikkhu Bodhi did his translation of this one in the Anguttara Fours, he titled it Unattractiveness. And when Ajahn Sujata did his translation, he couldn't use Bhikkhu Bodhi's for Sutta Central, so he actually had to find another title, and he called it Ugly. And I thought, what a wonderful title for a sutta, Ugly, because it kind of attracts you. What's this all about? But anyway, these are the four types of modes of practice, and why that one is difficult and slow, the other one is difficult and fast, pleasant and slow, and pleasant and fast. And I have even quoted those at brief, almost saying, well, which one would you rather have of those four? When I saw that, I thought, well, I think I'll have the pleasant and fast. But it's not so much up to you as up to your defilements and stuff. So anyway, this one I have obviously amended, changed some of the terms, especially number one, to make it gender neutral. And number two is a few other little terms which weren't really clear in the original, cleared it up. And especially when we start talking about jhanas, again, some of the translations I've seen of jhanas, it just really needs a lot of work. So anyway, this is my translation. So, unattractiveness, or ugly if you wish. And what, meditators, is a practice that I... excuse me. What, meditators, is the practice that is unpleasant with slow direct knowledge. The direct knowledge was the experience of the truth. And they call it direct because it's right up to you, comes from inside of you, not from teachers outside. It may have been triggered by teachings you have heard or read, but it's your own direct knowledge. What, meditators, is the practice that is unpleasant with slow direct knowledge? Here, a meditator dwells contemplating the unattractiveness of the body, perceiving the repulsiveness of food, perceiving non-delight in the entire world, contemplating impermanence in all conditioned phenomena, and they have the perception of death well established internally. Now, of course, that is usually the reflections we call the asupa, the unattractiveness. And those are usually only recommended for those who have too much lust, desire for the world. because if you find somebody who comes to you who's depressed, upset, not having much going for them in their life, and then you ask them to dwell contemplating unattractiveness, repulsiveness of food, non-delight in the entire world, impermanence in everything, and get the perception of death well established in you, I don't think that's going to help them very much. So it is teachings which are aimed for certain people. But nevertheless, that sometimes people take these things as a meditation object, the repulsiveness, the negativity of life. And then they dwell depending upon these five trainee powers. These are five things which actually help you on the path. The power of faith or confidence. And sometimes when people ask what's the difference between faith and just blind belief, and I think that the Francis Story who says that faith or confidence is faith supported by reason, whereas blind faith is faith in spite of reason. So reason has its place. And the power of moral shame and moral dread. The power of moral shame, again, is thinking that, well, you know, I'm a husband, a father. There's certain things I don't want, you know, to my son to follow. I shouldn't do that sort of stuff. It's unbefitting of me. Or if you are a monk or a nun, there's certain things which are expected of you, and you do not want to let, you know, the community down. So, you know, you have that sense of inner shame if you do anything wrong. No, I shouldn't have done that. It's not to the point of guilt where you want to beat yourself up, but more like, what did I do that for? I'm letting other people down. And also the power of moral dread, and that is realizing that there is consequences to one's actions. It's understanding how the law of karma works, that whatever you do, which may be inappropriate, unskillful, hurtful, breaking precepts, it does have consequences somewhere down the line, which you cannot escape. So that realizing that you cannot escape those consequences of whatever you do is a power in you which keeps you on the right track. And the power of energy and the power of wisdom. They say these are five powers, you know, for a trainee who has yet to develop their full power of keeping virtue. These five faculties and these further five faculties arise in them feebly. I did have weakly in there, but that's... that's one correction there which I missed. These five faculties arise in them weakly. The faculty of faith, faculty of energy, of mindfulness, of stillness, and of wisdom. Those are the five indriyas, the controlling faculties, which is one of the things which is supposed to help one grow stronger and stronger on the path. And obviously the faculty of faith, of energy, and mindfulness, of stillness, and of wisdom. Now sometimes people may have heard that these have to be balanced, that faith is balanced by wisdom and energy is balanced by stillness. And people who say that, there is no source for that teaching or that idea in the suttas. Sometimes I think there was one quote about it in the commentaries or the Abhidhamma, but that's certainly not tenable. Stillness is a high energy state, and it's great to have energy to create that stillness. And faith and wisdom, the more faith one has, the more you can test that faith out, get the wisdom, and the wisdom reinforces the faith. So the faith and the wisdom can be as strong as you like. Energy can be strong and stillness can be strong. So all of those things, it's not that one balances the other. They can all really have strong, a very strong power to them. And anyway, in this case, because if the five faculties are weak, then they slowly reach the absence of obstacles for the destruction of the outflowings. Now, there's two words in there which people always translate differently. First of all, there's the word the asavas, which I have translated as outflowings, which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as taints. It literally means asava, literally means like things which are flowing outwards, or it could be things which are coming inwards. And to me, that it makes more sense, that the point being that the mind goes out into the world, it goes out to play in the playground of sensuality. It's like you can't stay inside, so the mind goes out. That's the outflowings which create desires, ill will, and a delusion that you're in control of things. So those outflowings, to me, is a far more accurate and meaningful translation of this word asava, instead of like taints. And anyway, the destruction of the outflowings, the taints, that is a synonym meaning fully enlightened. Now the other word there in this is the anantariya, which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as, what has he got it here? I've got it back to 163. And he attains the immediacy condition for the destruction of the taints. It doesn't really make much sense to me, but the word, I just went through his explanation why he chose that, and it is true, anantariya only occurs a couple of places in the suttas, but it does occur in the Vinaya, and it's from the Vinaya where you get a much more accurate understanding of the meaning of these terms. And to understand what this word, why I call it absence of obstacles, is that there was a monk called Ritta, and he said, oh, sensuality, you know, that's part of being a human being. You know, you can't avoid sensuality. And to say that sensuality, you know, including all types of sensuality and even sexuality, is not really an obstacle to on the path. And as a result of that, the monks tried to convince him, and the monks individually couldn't convince him, and so they had a rule of what to do when a monk is of really what I call the dangerous wrong views, and spread them around and cause a lot of trouble. And the word there is, again, antariya, and the opposite of that is anantariya. So the idea being an obstacle to the path, a thing which actually prevents you going further. And so the word I have used here is the absence of obstacles. In other words, you have a clear path to enlightenment. So, because these five faculties are weak, they slowly reach that point where it's clear all the way to Nibbana. This is called the practice that is unpleasant with slow direct knowledge. What is the practice that is unpleasant with quick direct knowledge? Here, a meditator dwells, again doing asupa, contemplating on the unpleasant, contemplating the unattractiveness of the body, perceiving the repulsiveness of food, perceiving not delighting the entire world, contemplating impermanence and all conditioned phenomena, and they have the perception of death well established internally. And that's one of the ways you can see that if a person really does that with a right attitude, it means that their lust, ill will, tends to get very, very weak, wanting something beautiful. And it's really weird as a monk these days, getting old and not being interested in sexuality anymore. Just what was it a couple of days ago? Just was having lunch, a lunch dana. And it was in quite a wealthy person's house, and they said, oh, you know, this lady over here, she's a really famous Taiwanese singer and actress. Really? And apparently, that, you know, some guys, especially in Taiwan, would swoon over her. I don't know, I can't understand it these days. But anyway, looked at her, yeah, she was a girl. I knew that much. But you know why people are attractive? Sometimes, what is beauty anyway, and attractiveness? And one thing I do remember, just going into portrait galleries when I was young, and seeing all the really attractive women, you know, in those portrait galleries, you know, painted 100 years ago, they were all plump. Or let's put it another way, fat. So if anyone is a fat woman, you were just born at the wrong time. You know, years ago, 100 years ago, you would be really gorgeous. But nowadays, skinny women are gorgeous, apparently. And so anyone who was skinny 100 years ago, people would not keep clear of them. They think they were sick and got some terrible disease they didn't want to catch. So anyway, for those of you who worry about your size or your shape or your weight, it's just, you know, born at the wrong time. Does that make any sense to you? Okay. But anyway, the repulsiveness of the body and just the repulsiveness of food. And I know another monk who did that once, repulsiveness of food, started thinking that what goes in your mouth comes out the other end. So, the food they had in front of them in their bowl, they looked upon that and they said, well, you know, what actually is this food? It is all the nutrients, the vitamins or whatever, and the carbohydrates which your body absorbs, and what's left is this brown smelly stuff which comes out afterwards. So the brown smelly stuff is actually there in your food. It's right there, but it's other stuff is taken out and this is what's left. It doesn't come from anywhere else, it just comes from what goes in your mouth. So he said, what I'm eating is just, you know, this really terrible feces and other stuff as well. And that soon made him be quite repulsive of food. And I remember seeing this monk, it wasn't me. He had his bowl in front of him in the monastery. And he looked at it, repulsiveness of food, I can't eat this, and pushed it away. And he said, no, but I have to care for my body. And he pulled it towards him. And we saw him pushing it away, putting it towards him, pushing it away, because he couldn't decide whether to eat it or not. Crazy. Anyway, such people, you know, they dwell in tribe because they've got lots of lust, or they're very sort of an angry person. Because they see unattractiveness of in the world, they're pushing themselves away from the world. They still dwell upon these five training powers, the faith, moral shame, moral dread, energy and wisdom, and, you know, to keep their virtue going. And the five faculties arise in them strongly, the five indriyas, faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. The five, they call them controlling faculties. When they get strong and established, they're called bala, strengths. So those faculties necessary to get enlightened, they become so strong that they quickly reach the place where there's no obstacles for enlightenment, for the destruction of the outflowings. So this is called the practice that is unpleasant with quick direct knowledge. And what is the practice that is pleasant with slow direct knowledge? Here, so instead of focusing on the negativity of life, here, secluded from the five senses, secluded from the five hindrances, a meditator enters and dwells in the first jhana, experience the bliss born of being apart from the five senses, accompanied by a subtle grasping of the bliss, moving away from the bliss and then back onto it. With it, and you recognize that as a translation by Ajahn Brahm. With a subsiding of the moving away from the bliss and then back onto it, they enter and dwell in the second jhana, which has inner confidence in the bliss, enough to stop grasping it. You don't have to hold it because it's not going anywhere. And thereby unification of mind, experience the bliss born of stillness. With a fading away of the rapture part of bliss, They dwell content and mindful, experience a pleasure free of rapture. They enter and dwell in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare they are content and mindful, dwelling happily. Now, of course, I've experimented with a different translation of upeka, where they say equanimous. That really doesn't cut it for me, just being equanimous. It's like you're being dead. But this is being content. The only reason why contentment hasn't been used for a long time is because it's a common translation for another word, another part of the word called santuti. But I think it really just makes more sense to call that contentment, use that word contentment for upeka, usually called equanimity, and instead call it contentment. So see how you feel about that. So the fading away, the rapture part of bliss, they dwell content and mindful, experience a pleasure full of rapture. They dwell in the third jhana. They are content and mindful, dwelling happily. And lastly, with the abandoning of the five sense pleasures and suffering, this is all of the happiness and suffering of the five senses. This is almost like a summary. This is not what one does between third and fourth jhana. This has already been done. And with the previous passing away of the sixth sense, joy and suffering, that's the happiness of the mind and the suffering of the mind, they enter and dwell in the fourth jhana, experiencing only mental contentment. Mental in the sense of the sixth sense, not being able to feel the body, but mindfully really content, which has purification of mindfulness through contentment. And I love the way that the Buddha mentioned the purification of mindfulness. It cannot get more pure, more strong than this, simply because many people feel that in these jhanas that you are totally in a trance, that you are not conscious, that you are not mindful. You do have mindfulness. It's not of the body. It's not of sight, sound, smell, taste, or again, physical touch on the body. All that mindfulness is going into the mind, you know, and the object is usually the bliss. So such people, gaining those four jhanas, they dwell depending upon these five trainee powers, the powers of faith, moral shame, moral dread, energy, and wisdom. And these five faculties arise in them weakly, the faculty of faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. Because these five faculties are weak, they slowly reach the absence of obstacles for the destruction of the outflowings. This is called practice that is pleasant with sluggish direct knowledge. And you would wonder why, sometimes I would wonder why, that they have the jhanas. How come their faith, their energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom is weak? And, you know, it probably is because of the factor of ego. So just like Devadatta had the jhanas, but still would not have the wisdom and the faith, you know, to be able to see that these are not his possessions, and they don't make him a greater monk. And so he decided he wanted to take over the sasana, the religion, and try and kill the Buddha. So there will be a time when the energy, mindfulness, and stillness would be strong, but the faith and wisdom would still be weak. And lastly, and what is a practice that is pleasant with quick direct knowledge? He is secluded from the five senses, secluded from the five hindrances, a meditator enters and dwells in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. They dwell depending on his five training powers, the power of faith, moral shame, moral dread, energy and wisdom. And these five faculties arise in them strongly. The faculty of faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness and wisdom. Because these five faculties are strong, they quickly reach the absence of obstacles for the destruction of the outflowings. This is called a practice that is pleasant with quick direct knowledge. These meditators are the four modes of practice. So in summary, that those four modes, they are painful or pleasant depending upon the meditation objects, you know, what one is actually using. If you're using the negative meditation objects, because you find that you're very attracted to the world and you really do want to get rid of those attractions by, you know, what is contemplating the faults of repulsiveness in things, then that is an unpleasant way. But if it is a pleasant path, that is usually because of the using the jhanas, incredibly pleasant. Not to see that the world is bad, but there's something which is better, the bliss of the deep meditations. And the speed, the fastness or the slowness of your development depends upon these the five faculties, the indriyas, the faith, the energy, mindfulness, stillness and wisdom. And of course faith is always a very dangerous thing to develop, because people have faith in all sorts of things, and sometimes what they have faith in turns out to be quite harmful. But nevertheless, a degree of faith, growing carefully, and not just believing just, you know, because somebody who's, you know, who's very famous says so. So you find it out, you test it out, you use your reason, but also use some inspiration as well. So the faculty of faith, the energy, as you meditate even more and more, you get more energy. And sometimes the word energy in Pali is called virya, and it's related to the word vira, which is like a hero. It's almost like sacrificial energy. The idea in Buddhism in that time is just like an elephant who goes into battle and willing to sacrifice everything, you know, for the cause. So it's somebody who has so much energy, you're willing to let go of everything. It's almost like a heroic letting go type of energy. And mindfulness, we all know what that is. That is such a well-used word. Stillness is the samadhi. And the sama samadhi is a mind not concentrated, because that's unpleasant. And it cannot be sustained, but just the mind being so still and peaceful. And, of course, wisdom. And if those five faculties are strong, then the path is fast. When those faculties are weak, then the path is slow. And a reason why somebody asked me to talk about this is they say some people are going around and say, see, it's only the last two they mention, the jhanas, so you don't really need the jhanas, you can do the other ways of contemplating unattractiveness of the body, repulsion of the body, non-delight in the entire world, contemplating impermanence in all conditioned phenomena, and have the perception of death fairly well established internally. Even so, if you want to follow that path, fine, but be careful, you might get depressed. I see many people get depressed on that, sometimes it's quite weird. But that even that way, you still eventually, because you let go of the five sense world, the attachment to that world gets very weak. So it's easier to actually develop the five faculties, especially energy, mindfulness, and stillness. Stillness is always in there, no matter which way of those four you practice. And stillness, the samadhi, sama samadhi, the correct samadhi, is always the jhanas. So, any questions on that before we go on to the next sutta? Which is?
I'd like to go back to the repulsiveness of the food.
Yeah. Use other people's flu.
No.
Repulsiveness of flu. No.
It's called a food transplant. It's gross.
Food transplant, really?
Poo, yes. They're using it to cure different things in other people. They pump it into them.
Okay.
And so I'm afraid you'll have to change it.
Okay, that's very interesting. I know that it's, again, a strange part of Buddhism, much faith, that sometimes when a monk finishes his food, that other people would, especially they think that monk is holy and very highly attained, they would take the leftover food and eat it for themselves. They think that's even more medicinal. I've seen that so many times in Thailand. I've never seen it in Sri Lanka, or I think it's Burma. Do they have that in Burma? Like monks' leftovers. Oh, that's another thing. You're right. Yeah, because I did that for about, how many years? 4 or 5 years. Every morning drank my urine. It wasn't repulsive at all. It's just what you add onto it. It was actually nice and warm, and when you didn't have a cup of tea or coffee in the morning in those forest monasteries, that was nice and salty. It's quite nice. The only reason I gave that up, interestingly, was that when I came to Australia in the summertime, many of you know how hard you used to work. You're working all day, mostly out in the sun. And in the morning, when I woke up, there was some urine in my body, but it was just so thick because I didn't not drink enough water. And so that was very unpleasant. So I decided, no, I'm not going to drink that. It's too concentrated. But, it's not repulsive at all. It's just what you add on to it. So many people do that. I think, was it even Amanda still does that? Anyway, it's just, whatever people think is a good idea or not. But anyway, that's another thing. But the repulsive food, doing that so that, your delight, your lust, your craving gets less and less and less. I've never heard of the food transplants. That's interesting. Yeah. Very good for you. Okay. So maybe I should eat more food so I have more things to give to other people for transplants. Okay, that's another good excuse. So again, just in brief, before I go on to the next sutta, and then is there someone from overseas? Okay. So the next sutta is another sutta which people often ask about. Again, trying to find a sixfold path or a sevenfold path where they don't have to meditate. And that is what we have called down there called Ananda. See if I can find that one now. I've got the ugly, my Ananda Sutta. Here we've got Ananda. Ah! Good. Oh. The trouble with these things, it's very easy to develop repulsiveness towards computers, very easy to do. So in conjunction, on one occasion the Venerable Ananda was dwelling at Kosambi in Gosita's park. There the Venerable Ananda addressed the bhikkhus. Straight away, this code there for anyone who understands just the way these suttas were put together, that because it never says where the Buddha was staying, this means that this sutta was after the death, the parinirvana of the Buddha. But nevertheless, Venerable Ananda was, again, one of the most senior monks, one of the most trusted, was understood to be fully enlightened after the time of the parinirvana, and he would often be the go-to person. And because these suttas were all collected just before the 3 months, 5 months after the Buddha's parinirvana, we could almost time this just in those 5 months, so it could actually get into the collection. On one occasion, the Venerable Ananda was dwelling at Kosambi in Gosita's park. There the Venerable Ananda addressed the bhikkhus. "Friends, bhikkhus, friends," those bhikkhus replied. And the Venerable Ananda said this, "Friends, whatever bhikkhu or bhikkhuni has declared the attainment of arahatship in my presence has done so by these four paths, or by a certain one among them. What for? Here a meditator develops insight, vipassana, preceded by calm. As they are developing insight, preceded by calm, the path becomes clear, they pursue this path, develop it and cultivate it. As they are pursuing, developing and cultivating this path, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted, which means they attain enlightenment. Again, a meditator develops calm preceded by insight, the other way around this time. As I develop in calm, preceded by insight, the path becomes clear. They pursue this path, develop it, and cultivate it. As they are pursuing, developing, and cultivating this path, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. The second path to enlightenment. Again, a meditator develops calm and insight together, vipassana and samatha all together. As they are developing calm and insight together, the path is generated, or that should be, the path becomes clear. They pursue this path, develop it and cultivate it. As they are pursuing, developing and cultivating this path, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. And the fourth path, which is always quoted, because that is a little bit, adds a more opportunity for people to interpret. Again, a meditator's mind is seized by restlessness about the Dhamma, Dhamma Udacha. But there comes an occasion when their mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and still. And I mention this here, I've got the Pali there just to remind me. It's santitati, it stands inside, it sits still. A kodi hoti means it comes to oneness, unification of mind. Samadhiati, it is stilled. And then the mind becomes, the path becomes clear. Sanjayati, it is the verb which is, corresponds to sanya, that's to perceive. Then the path becomes clear. They pursue this path, develop it and cultivate it. As they're pursuing, developing and cultivating this path, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Whatever bhikkhu or bhikkhuni friends has declared the attainment of arahatship in my presence has done so by these four paths or by a certain one among them. So there's no such thing as just pure vipassana. There's no such thing as pure samatha. Samatha, vipassana always go together. And many of you have gone on retreats where I explained just what I saw many times from Ajahn Chah, who would put his hand up and say, this is the front of my hand. And then he'd turn it around, this is the back of my hand. That you only see the back of my hand, but the front of my hand is there. Now you see the front of my hand, the back of the hand is still there, because the front and back cannot be separated. And so he would say, this is samatha, this is vipassana, you cannot split them up. This is samatha taking the lead, this is vipassana taking the lead, this is them going together. But even the fourth way, where it says the mind is seized by restlessness and a bit of doubt, a bit of there still comes the occasion when your mind becomes internally steady, composed, and unified, and still. That is still code. It's been summited. It's been calmed down. Then the path becomes clear. That's almost like a vipassana. And then they pursue this path, develop it and cultivating it. It's always the case that there's four ways, they all come to the point where the path becomes clear. And it seems almost obvious that that means they attain to being the stream winner. They know what the path is. They attain the path. One of the synonyms for a stream winner is dittipato. Attain to view, they know what the path is. And then, afterwards, they pursue this path, develop it and cultivating it. So once you know the path, or in a simile of the shipwrecked sailors, which I also often use, because it gives a metaphor which is easy to get your head around, that a sailor at sea looks around and sees in a reachable distance that there is dry land. That's seeing the path. That's the stream winner. You know what you've got to do. And then, of course, they start swimming towards the dry land. And as they swim towards the dry land, they're on the path. They're developing that path. They see the way to go. And as they get closer and closer to dry land, they're so close they don't need to swim anymore. They can stand in the surf and wade to the shore. And then once they're at the shore, they can just sit under a nice coconut tree and just resuscitate, regain their strength by having a nice cool coconut to drink. And in that simile, the seeing the path, seeing which way you're supposed to go, seeing the dry land, that is seeing the path, that is becoming a stream winner. And then developing that path. And then as you are swimming towards land, that's being like a once returner. And then as you reach close to the shore, you can stand up in the surf, that's like being a non-returner, anagami, and then of course it's so close, you wade the rest of the way to the shore, and then you are safe and secure. That's called nibbana. That's the Buddha simile of the shipwreck sailors. So, those are the two vipassana and samatha similes. Do you want me to go further with my simile of samatha and vipassana? Okay, this is what I usually teach on retreats. So, there were these two, this couple, and I don't know if they were married or not, but anyway, they lived together, Samatha and Vipassana. And Sam and Vi, one day after lunch, decided to go on a walk up Meditation Mountain. Sam wanted to go up to top of Meditation Mountain because it was so peaceful up there, it was so still, and he loved the serenity on top on top of Meditation Mountain. Vi, his partner, Vipassana, wanted to go up there because she liked taking these photographs on top of Meditation Mountain. And it's amazing, you could see forever up there. You got some incredible views up on top of Meditation Mountain. So she took her professional, you know, Canon with different camera, not one of these sort of iPhone ones, but this really professional camera with different filters and all sorts of stuff, because she wanted to get some photographs, some really good insights up on the top of Meditation Mountain. But they also had two dogs with them. So the dogs went on a walk as well. One of the dogs was called Metta, and the other one was called Anapana. Anapanasati. Okay, no, breath meditation. Anyway, so what did the two dogs go up there for? You ask a dog why they want to go for a walk. There's no purpose, just for fun. Now, sometimes I think the dogs are a higher being. But anyway, the two dogs went up Meditation Mountain with Sam and Vi, and when they'd only gone up halfway, it was so still. It was so serene, even halfway up Meditation Mountain. Oh, that Sam was enjoying it so much. And even though it was halfway up, Vipassana was taking these incredible views. You could see so much more detail up there. She had great insights and understandings. Metta the dog. Wow, Metta the dog was just so happy, even halfway up Meditation Mountain. And Anapana, the other dog, you know, sometimes you could hardly see her. Anapana was disappearing. But when they got right to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, it was so serene. Stillness like you've never experienced up there. So Sam was just so blissed out. But even he had a pair of eyes that could see the magnificent view. Vi, she was taking these incredible shots, photographs, insights, which would change people's lives forever. But she could also appreciate the powerful magic of stillness up on top of Meditation Mountain. Metta the dog. What happens? Have you ever seen a dog who's really blissed out, running around, wagging her tail like it's going to fall off? She didn't make any noise though, because she also appreciated the stillness. And sometimes she stopped wagging her tail just to stop and look at the incredible views and appreciate the really deep stillness. And as for Anapana, the breath, she totally disappeared. You couldn't find her up there, because at the top of Meditation Mountain is still incredible insights, a lot of metta, sometimes samatha vipassana, we should actually put metta in there as well. And the breath vanishes on top of Meditation Mountain. It disappears. Perfectly healthy, not a health hazard, but just beautiful, no breathing, but just peace, insight, and incredible loving kindness at the top of Meditation Mountain. So that's my simile, just to make it a bit more interesting, of the Sam, Atta, Sam and Vi, the two dogs, Metta and Anapana. So, any questions or comments or complaints about the sutta today? Yeah, we got some from overseas. Here we go. Singapore, what is the difference between tanha craving and asawa's outflowings? Why did the Buddha mention tanha in some teachings and asawa's in others? It is because the craving creates the outflowings. They are connected together. Once you crave or you want something, the mind goes out to try and catch it or get it. It's what motivates the outflowings. That's one of the reasons why I like the word outflowings. You can see that happening in your day. So I'm like sitting there bored, what should I do today? And you send the mind out because of ill will. Or it could be of like craving, wanting something. Oh, just I need a glass of water. So as soon as I said that, my mind went out to get some. I drank it, so I'm now satisfied. But the craving, the wanting, and sending the mind out. So it means you can't be still. You miss out on peace. So it's almost like the craving creates the asavas, and the asavas sort of support the craving. From the Netherlands, I experienced great meditation while in Thailand. Total freedom and control. Once I got home, it was different, and I lost this. How can I keep the best mindset for deep meditation? If it's for deep meditation, it's so common that people get a really deep meditation first, and they can't get it back again for years. I know that because that happened to me. And then it took a while, I'd striving, struggling, wanting, and then couldn't get it back. But I was fortunate enough to go to a really great monk like Ajahn Chah, and who started teaching you, you meditate to let go, not to get things. To have less, not more. To renounce, not to have spiritual materialism. See how many how many deep meditations you have. So when I got that message, you realized it was because I wanted to get back there. And so these days, you know, once you were with an Ajahn Chah, you got back again, and it was great. But a lot of the time, if you want anything, find out the causes for that deep meditation, or those great meditations while in Thailand. Why? Recreate the causes. Don't recreate the results. Get the causes back in place. And I see Germany. Should we spice up stillness in meditation with loving kindness? I was going to sort of reject that suggestion, because I don't like spices. They make my tummy sick. I used to have all this really hot food in Thailand, and sometimes I didn't know what I was eating until after I'd eaten it. Oh my goodness, you know, your face would go red, your eyes would weep, and stuff would come out of your nose, and you felt really sick because of too much chili. Why the heck do they call it chili when it's so hot? So anyway, but I think I know what you mean. Spice up stillness with meditation with loving kindness, great. Does not stillness not generate kindness and compassion automatically? Yes, it does, but nevertheless, you can never go wrong adding some loving kindness to whatever you're doing. And experiment, try it out. Because sometimes when we just stay with, you know, what your teacher says or what the books say, then sometimes we change it a tiny bit, and we find actually it makes it more powerful. And you go back to the book or back to the teacher, and that's what he said all along, but you missed it. So I recall, I always was taught loving kindness only goes towards living beings. May all beings be happy and well. But then, why not things? So I just experimented, and one of the first things I experimented with loving kindness was on my breathing. I gave this beautiful loving kindness to my breathing, combined loving kindness meditation with my breath. My breath has been giving me oxygen ever since I was born, hasn't let me down yet, which is why I'm still here. And it takes all these waste products out. It's been working 24/7 for the last almost 68 years. Thank you, breath. And this beautiful kindness towards the breath. Just like it's my best friend, unacknowledged, uncared for. And I remember when I did that at a retreat, really tired, and just doing loving kindness on the breath, that really blissed me out. That was when I remember just, I didn't sleep well that night. I was happy, but you know, I was just so happy just laying down too much energy. And then just when I just, I did fall asleep. But I dreamt of nimittas and what comes afterwards, and wow, that was one of the greatest nights, non-sleep. But anyway, because it works so well. So loving kindness and stillness, yeah, get into it. They can go together really, really well. Yeah, one will generate the other. You know, you can't separate them really. But nevertheless, if you want to give a little bit more power to the meditation, loving kindness, opening the door of your heart to what you're experiencing. Especially with this, not just with acceptance, but with the warm acceptance. I love you, breath. Oh. And then you just can't be separated from it. And you're with it, the breath, with great joy. And it really just gets into incredible deep meditations. So certainly, you can never add too much loving kindness. I say that, spice it up, yeah, really go for it. Anyway, it does happen automatically, but it's now automatic because I suggested that, and I've been brainwashing you for the last 5 minutes, that there, you will do it, and it's wonderful. So any further questions from here? Okay. Again, it's a short sutta today, and I did that on purpose, because I didn't know how my cough was going to be, and I did think that there wouldn't be that many people here today because you've had 9 days of suttas with Ajahn Bhumali, and also that these questions came up, so I thought it would be good to answer them. Anything? Going? Gone. Okay, so now we can give the blessing. The sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Excellent. So did you all understand that, or could you not understand it? There's two reasons why people are silent after you've given a talk. One is they couldn't hear, they didn't have the earplugs in. Number two, it was too deep, or it was just too easy. Anyway, whatever. So we can now just do bang 3 times and do Arahang Sammasambuddha.